What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest on Too Jewish is Libby Fisher-Hellman, author of the new book, Max's War. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Last Sunday morning in the Los Angeles neighborhood I grew up in, it's called Pico Robertson, where my parents lived for, I don't know, 70 years or so, well, things got really ugly. A mob of pro-Palestinian terrorist supporters wearing face masks and keffiyehs to hide their cowardly identity attacked Jews arriving at Adas Torah Synagogue on Pico Boulevard. The terrorist supporters used bear spray, flags with spikes on them, fists and boots, among other weapons, on pro-Israel supporters who then responded to the attacks. The goal of these pro-Palestinian terrorist supporters, who blocked Pico Boulevard in the most densely Jewish neighborhood on the whole West Coast, was to stop a forum held promoting real estate in Israel that was being held at the temple. The Palestinian terrorist sympathizers shouted a variety of anti-Semitic slogans like "Globalize the Intifada" and "From the River to the Sea" and such. And for a while, they blocked the entrance to the Orthodox Synagogue, a modern building in the heart of an intensely Jewish area. Los Angeles police took a while to push back the pro-Palestinian terrorist supporters and allow people to enter the shul. Condemnation of the violent anti-Semitic demonstration was rapid. A number of videos that were posted showed fist fights, people being sprayed by these pro-Palestinian terrorists, and the like. I'm appalled by the scenes outside of Adas Torah Synagogue in Los Angeles. Intimidating Jewish congregants is dangerous, unconscionable, anti-Semitic, and un-American, said President Biden. Americans have a right to peaceful protest, but blocking access to a house of worship and engaging in violence is never acceptable. California Governor Gavin Newsom said the violent clashes outside the Adas Torah Synagogue in Los Angeles are appalling. There is no excuse for targeting a house of worship. Such anti-Semitic hatred has no place in California. At a news conference the next day, Los Angeles Police Department Interim Chief Dominic Choi said LAPD detectives are investigating all acts of violence. He added that while residents are okay to protest peacefully, violence will not be tolerated. At the same news conference, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass said she plans to meet with the city attorney's office, talk about the potential for permits for protests, people wearing masks at protests, and establishing clear lines of demarcation between what is legal and what is not. Bass said she will also convene a meeting of leaders of houses of worship and cultural centers to discuss how to protect sacred spaces and keep congregants safe. Police will enhance their partnership with Jewish public safety organizations in order to review threats to the community, the mayor of LA said. Now, I know some people will make a distinction between promoting Israeli real estate at a synagogue and praying or studying there. But blocking the entrance to a Jewish house of worship, just like vandalizing or burning one down, which happened last week across the world in the Russian state of Dagestan, is in all cases an act of anti-Semitism. Imagine if, say, the entrance to a Catholic cathedral in America were to be blocked by Jewish birth control advocates, or entrance to a mosque blocked by Christians protesting Hamas's brutal assault on innocent civilians. You have to imagine it, because it hasn't happened. Jews don't block churches. Christians don't block mosques. But these kinds of attacks on synagogues are now becoming normalized, part of the pro-terrorist network of Palestinian supporters at work in America today. You know, growing up around Pico Robertson in my childhood, that neighborhood wasn't all Jewish by any means. It was a decidedly mixed community, and not all that safe, frankly, but I never experienced any kind of public anti-Semitism. I'm not saying it was some sort of idyllic place of mutual cooperation. It wasn't that. But the idea that there could be a large anti-Semitic rally by masked people in the streets on Pico Boulevard shouting that Israel shouldn't exist, that was beyond all comprehension. I wish it still was, of course, as we approach the 4th of July this week. You know, this push to cultivate hatred towards Jews that's afoot all over America remains, well, horrible but stunning. That's not to say that everything Israel does is right or good, of course, or that the situation in Gaza is anything but tragic. But to deliberately target Jews anywhere and everywhere just because they are Jews is to give in to the worst hatred in the history of humanity and the longest running, and to do so gleefully. It's ugly, it's wrong, it's destructive, particularly of the course it's trying to support. And it needs to be stopped. Whether in Los Angeles, New York, the Bay Area, anywhere and everywhere else it exists. On a happier note to play us in this morning, here's an actual love song from Ibn Hasson called Ani Ohev Otach Kol Hayom, from Israel, written by Dolly and Penn. I love you all day, every day.
הימים נפתחים לי אחרת, מחייך יותר כשאת מאלתרת לי ארוחות מהלב. יושבים כל ערב לשיחות במרפסת ומשחקים עם השפתיים תופסת, כי את יודעת שזה עושה לי להתאהב. ורק תודה לאלוהים שהקשיב לי, גם התפילות שלי עייפו אבל חיכיתי שתגיע עד אליי. איזה מזל שאת הגעת, אחרי מסע שלם מחזיק לך בידיים, הפכת אותי לילד טוב ירושלים. ופתאום לאט לאט מדמיין אותך איתי, רק תדעי שאין עוד כמוך, שמחיוך אחד הלב שלי נשרף ומתקן בי את הכל. הלוואי ותדעי אני כאן עד הסוף, כי משמיים הם שלחו אליי אותך לאהוב אותך כל יום.
היו תקופות שקצת איבדתי את הדרך, עם השקר התהלכתי כמו מלך, הסתבר שחיכיתי לך יותר מדי. וכל שפוי הלב נמצא לי בבית, את שוב רומזת לי כל יום שעדיין, איך בא לי שתכתוב שיר עליי. אחרי מסע שלם מחזיק לך בידיים, הפכת אותי לילד טוב ירושלים. ופתאום לאט לאט מדמיין אותך אשתי, רק תגיד
That was Eden Chasson singing Ani Ohev Otach Kol Hayom. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Libby Fisher-Hellman, popular author of some 18 crime, thriller, and historical novels, tells us the dramatic and often untold true-life origin of her new book, Max's War. It's based on a secret World War II American military program and, well, her own relative's life story. Hear all about it when we come back in just a moment on To Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Libby Fisher-Hellman is the writer of compulsively readable thrillers. Her new book is called Max's War, which is set in the period of the Holocaust and World War II. And I have to confess, my interest in it to some degree stems from personal experience of a guy who did something very similar to the protagonist in this book. Good morning and welcome to To Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi Sam. I'm happy to be here.
So what prompted you to write Max's War?
I have always been a World War II junkie, for better or worse, that's the word I use. And I have been attracted to stories, not necessarily about the Holocaust, but about the war as well, how people were displaced, what happened to families, and of course the Jewish persecution. It turns out that my late father-in-law was recruited by the OSS, and he had started out in Germany. He and his family fled to Holland, and then he was the only one who could make it to the United States after Hitler invaded Holland. So I was very curious as to how he ended up in the OSS. And that kind of started my research.
So I'll tell you my little story. A friend met him in 99, I think, maybe 98. No, 99. Was the kind of guy that you would just underestimate. He was, you know, kind of a short, roly-poly guy, always big smile on his face. And he had actually at some point been a vice president of General Electric. So he had clearly accomplished a lot in life. But his stories about World War II came out later. And in fact, his story was similar. He had been recruited by the OSS. And he was a kind of guy, he was sent on ahead of the Allied armies after D-Day. And he would, because he spoke fluent German, his family spoke German at home growing up. And he would report back by secret radio transmission to the Allies as to what they were about to encounter. And when they took over a town, he would tell the people who was the Nazis, who were the collaborators, who mm-hmm. were the resistance. It's incredible. It's a real thing. I mean, this obviously happened.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, my father-in-law interrogated enemy POWs. He also did field intelligence on German troop movements, and never talked about it after he got back. Many World War II vets just don't want to talk about their time in the war.
Right. So did you eventually get him to talk about it?
Well, little anecdotes slipped out. So wherever there was an anecdote, it's in the book. Where there isn't an anecdote, or I made it up. That's why I call it a novel. It is novel. But it's all, every single page is based on actual research, and research which is accurate.
We will talk more. This is just kind of the vorspeise of the interview with Libby Fisher-Hellman. Her book is called Max's War. It is compulsively readable, and we will talk more about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills, continues to celebrate wonderful services, classes, and events this summer. Established almost 6 years ago now by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night, 6:30 p.m., wonderful air conditioning where we are, followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, and Kiddush afterwards. All services are on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. You can attend our classes on Zoom and our services on our Facebook Live page. That's Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson on Facebook. Religious school is available now. Register your school-age children or grandchildren. Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Our adult education academy classes, which range from Hebrew to mysticism and everything in between, are also available at our website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, Hebrew Marathon, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on our Facebook page, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing and most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. Hear all past and present shows through the website, toojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as ridiculously popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, please, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. All those comments help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, elections have been held in Europe recently that I think are deeply concerning for, well, Jews certainly, in which we've seen a resurgence of far-right parties, both in France and then in the European Union elections. Tell us what's going on, because it's of grave concern, I think.
Okay, so first of all, those elections were for the European Parliament, which is an institution that doesn't really do very much. So many voters don't care or give a lot of thought to their choices in those elections. But the fact that all over Europe, the far-right parties did so well in these elections is a red flag. And the extreme success of the far-right party in France caused President Macron to call like snap elections, which will like always happen in two rounds that are separated by a week or so, in late this month and early next month. And that's a huge gamble because his assumption is that when it comes to actual French elections that matter to the French people, they won't vote for extreme parties, and that his party will emerge triumphant or stronger than it looks now after these European Parliament elections. But some other interesting things came out in these elections, which is, for example, in France, the Socialist Party has been moribund, but practically dead for the past several years. And it once was in significant power. First of all, the first Jewish prime minister of France, Léon Blum, was a socialist, as you might guess from his name, also a Jew.
I knew that already, actually, but yes.
And then President Mitterrand was a socialist and a stalwart of the Socialist Party. And they did well for many years, and then they had some weak leadership, and they just sort of faded into the background the way that historically over the past 50 years, the French Communist Party, which was once significant and a real player in French politics, basically vanished. It evanesced. It wasn't destroyed from the outside. It just kind of
disappeared.
Evaporated.
Yeah.
So that seemed to be happening with the Socialist Party, but under a Jewish leader named Glucksmann, the Socialist Party did surprisingly well and won a small but significant block of seats in parliament, especially if there has to be a coalition government, which may be the case after these next elections. And the evolution of the French Socialist Party in recent years has shown that it can move to the center and form alliances in a reasonable way. That was probably one of the greatest legacies of Mitterrand, was making the Socialist Party in France much more mainstream, less doctrinaire, more practical, less dogmatic. And that's probably why Mitterrand won 2 7-year terms as president.
So I'm curious about, not curious, but concerned about this kind of worldwide rise of what looks to those of us who are observers of kind of a fascist element, not only in French politics, but so many places around the world. It's not clear what the origins of that are.
Right. Well, there's two tendencies that sort of converge in a way. One is the increasing popularity of really autocratic leaders. I mean, you can't really say whether the Chinese Communist Party is left, right, or center. It's just the party, and it rules in a very autocratic manner.
And Xi has certainly consolidated power there.
Right, and you could say the same for Putin. He's not necessarily left, right, or center. He's Putin. And he's an autocrat, as is the current president of Hungary and several others. So that's one thing, these autocratic, sort of highly personal leaders. The other thing is parties on the far right, ultra-nationalist parties, sort of surging for reasons that we'll look into next time.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Saul is distraught. He has 3 sons, each with black hair and brown eyes, just like him. But now his wife, Sadie, has just given birth to a daughter with red hair and blue eyes. He goes to his wife and asks, "Sadie, be honest with me. Am I really the father of this girl?" Sadie is shocked and astonished. "Of course you are, Saul," she answers. Over the next 40 years, Saul continues to wonder. On occasion, he will ask his wife, "Sadie, be honest with me. Am I the father of this girl?" Each time, Sadie was shocked and astonished. "Of course you are, Saul." Finally, it's getting late. Sadie is on her deathbed. Sad beyond belief, Saul still has to know about his red-haired, blue-eyed daughter. "Sadie, be honest with me. Am I the father of our daughter?" Sadie gestures for him to lean close. He comes towards her as she gently struggles to speak. "Saul, look me in the eyes." Saul looks at her, his eyes tearing. "I have always told you the truth about our daughter. Of course you are her father, Saul." Relieved, Saul sighs, "Thank you, Sadie." But the boys... That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Yet another joke I cannot tell from the pulpit. And now a word of Torah. This week our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's Torah portion, the people of Israel have come to the very borders of the Promised Land, just a couple of years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies comes back with a bad report. "We aren't strong enough to conquer the land." Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Well, that revolt fails and a verdict is proclaimed. A lack of faith lies at the heart of the problem. God decides that this generation will never come into the Holy Land. We'll have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they are all gone, and a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth, untainted by slavery and its mentality, can come forward. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Kohen named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. He accuses them of hubris, of overweening pride, egotism. Born into the same Levitical tribe, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own. "Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron," he asks, "to take the authority of ruling over us?" Korach's rebellion threatens the very foundations of the Israelites' leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, it's all a matter of personal ego and self-aggrandizement, well then they might as well just go back to Egypt and live in slavery. And some propose now to do just that. But Korach lies. Moses clearly has no desire for this high office. He has held it instead as a sacred trust, given to him, nearly forced upon him by God. Korach is threatening God's authority, not Moses. Our Torah portion tells us that in order to determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match. The result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed, and Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. It's always nice when God has your back, right? One lesson of this Torah portion of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we need to look in the mirror. But the even more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, which is focused on personal aggrandizement, that will fail. Only through faith and devotion can we possibly reach our own promised land. When we come back in a moment, our guest, Libby Fisher-Hellman, tells us surprising facts and how she invented what she had to in telling the dramatic, untold, true-life origin of the story of Max's War, her novel based on a secret World War II American military program and her own relative's story. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli students at Harvard University face dire exclusion on campus, and other Jewish students are suffering because of political litmus tests to participate in clubs and activities, said a task force charged with reporting on anti-Semitism at Harvard. The task force was convened by the school's interim president, Alan Garber, in January, shortly after Harvard's previous president, Claudine Gay, resigned, following criticism of her handling of anti-Israel protests on campus. Task force released a set of preliminary recommendations last week. Harvard is the second elite college to receive official guidance in addressing campus anti-Semitism in the wake of Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel that followed Stanford University the week before. Stanford's report ran 146 pages, including detailed examples of Jewish students' anguished experiences on campus. Harvard's, by contrast, was just 6 pages, focused on what the task force said were short-term actionable items. A more detailed report, including a more intensive study of Jewish life on campus, is expected from Harvard in the fall, but the group said it did not want to wait before sharing initial findings. The situation over the past year has been quite grave. Unless we take significant steps forward, by the beginning of the coming academic year, we could be in a position similar to last year, which we want to prevent, Derek Penslar, co-chair of the Anti-Semitism Task Force, says. Despite the report's brevity, the task force, led by Penslar, a historian, and law professor Jared Elias, said its research was thorough. It conducted more than 40 listening sessions with more than 500 members of the Harvard community, representatives from the school's Hillel and Chabad centers among them. Some of its initial conclusions were quite blunt. The situation of Israeli students at Harvard has been dire. It says they have frequently been subject to derision and social exclusion, discrimination, bullying, harassment based on an individual's Israeli nationality is a gross violation of university policy. Beginning immediately, it must be both publicly condemned and subject to substantive disciplinary action. The report also condemned what it described as disturbing reports of Harvard faculty and teaching fellows harassing or discriminating against students because they are Israeli or have pro-Israel views, without elaborating on specific incidents. Many Jewish students also said they feared litmus tests for their views on Israel when engaging in extracurricular activities with peers. The task force recommendations included better communication around harassment reporting and disciplinary measures when it comes to the school's handling of claims of anti-Semitism. Harvard should also more prominently incorporate anti-Semitism training into its diversity, equity, and inclusion practices and establish better norms of civic engagement. Training for instructional staff and at student orientation programs must clarify the difference between a challenging classroom atmosphere, which is healthy and constructive, and a threatening one, which is toxic, Penslar said. Guidelines for co-curricular organizations and residencies should stress the importance of inclusivity, however contentious conversations within them may be. More practical recommendations for Jewish students included increasing kosher dining options and providing more accommodations for observant Jewish students when classes conflict with holidays or Shabbat. Harvard's handling of Jewish student concerns came under intense criticism after October 7th. President Claudine Gay resigned following a congressional hearing at which she could not say whether calls for the genocide of Jews violated university conduct. The school has also been the site of several Title VI investigations by the U.S. Department of Education. At commencement last week, the Harvard Chabad director publicly confronted an invited speaker over an anti-Semitic comment in her speech. And the task force itself has been rocky. At least 2 members, including a co-chair, resigned before the report's publication. Penslar, who directs Harvard Jewish Studies Center, weathered criticism from pro-Israel groups who believed his views were too progressive to moderate anti-Semitism. In addition, novelist Dara Horn, a many-time guest here on Too Jewish, who sat on an earlier iteration of this group and is a Harvard alum herself, has distanced herself from the group and become a vocal critic of Harvard's handling of anti-Semitism. In March, she sat for a congressional interview on the topic. In other news from the higher education front, 2 months after pulling his contributions from his Ivy League alma mater, Columbia, over its handling of pro-Palestinian terrorist protests, Robert Kraft announced a new donation to Yeshiva University. Last week, the billionaire philanthropist and owner of the New England Patriots announced he will donate $1 million to the country's flagship Modern Orthodox University to establish a program supporting incoming transfer students. The university has said it is experiencing an influx of students who left secular universities amid the protests. Kraft announced in April he is pulling his support from Columbia University, from which he graduated in 1963, and where he has donated millions of dollars. A sports field and the Jewish Student Center at Columbia bear Kraft's name. At the time, Kraft said he was no longer confident Columbia can protect its students and staff. I am not comfortable supporting the university until corrective action is taken. Since the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war, with Hamas's atrocities of October 7th, Columbia has been a hotspot of pro-Palestinian terrorist protest, which has rippled out to the rest of the country. Days before Kraft's announcement in April, Columbia students launched the pro-Palestinian terrorist encampment movement, which led to thousands of arrests nationwide and hostility to Jews on campuses all around the United States. Kraft is now directing some of his largesse towards Yeshiva University, which has sought to position itself as a safe haven for Jews who fear anti-Semitism at other schools. The same week, Kraft announced the suspension of his donations to Columbia. Yeshiva University in Uptown Manhattan said it would reopen applications for transfer students. No Jewish student should have to face the threats and intimidation that have sadly been taking place, said Rabbi Ari Berman, YU's president. While our enrollments are already full for the coming year, we at the flagship Jewish university would not turn our backs on these students. Kraft is the latest Jewish philanthropist to withdraw support from non-Jewish institutions over anti-Semitism concerns. Venture capitalist David Magerman, who pulled support from Penn last year over its response to campus anti-Semitism, or lack of response, announced last week he has donated $1 million to Israel's Jerusalem College of Technology. And last November, Jewish billionaire investor Henry Swieka quit the board of Columbia Business School, saying the campus had become unsafe for Jewish students. In Israel, they must now draft Haredi Orthodox Jews into the army, the country's Supreme Court ruled in a unanimous decision last week. The ruling could trigger a political earthquake in Israel when it is embroiled in a war in Gaza and has seen social unrest at home. The requirement to start drafting more than 60,000 ultra-Orthodox men into the army could lead to a sea change in military procedures, mass Haredi street protests, and the breakup of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's government, which includes Haredi parties irrevocably opposed to mandating ultra-Orthodox conscription. For decades, Israel has offered a blanket exemption from the army for young men enrolled full-time in learning at yeshivas, an accommodation that was first instituted in the early years of Israel when relatively few men fell into that category. As the Haredi Orthodox population ballooned, debate over continued exemptions from a draft that many Israelis see as the national duty has become increasingly heated. It's led to the rise and fall of multiple governments. Previous attempts to conscript Haredim have fallen flat despite large majority support from the Israeli public. Proponents argue that the exemptions create inequity in Israeli society and deprive the IDF of needed manpower. Haredi leaders contend Torah study has inherent value and serves to protect the state, and that accommodating the religious needs of Haredi men, ultra-Orthodox men that is, would itself be a burden for the army. I see they care so much. Haredi leaders supported Netanyahu's efforts last year to destroy the power of the Supreme Court, largely so they could avoid a ruling like this one. Since October 7th, concerns over IDF manpower and inequality have been deeply exacerbated by the war against Hamas, which spurred the largest military mobilization in Israel's history, with many reserve soldiers spending months and months in the reserves. When the latest blanket exemption law expired last year, Israel's right-wing government decided to continue to avoid conscripting yeshiva students, but that decision has drawn criticism from many of Netanyahu's allies, as well as his critics. Now, nine judges on Israel's high court unanimously ruled the government must begin conscripting Haredi ultra-Orthodox men and cannot continue funding yeshivas that enroll Haredi men in lieu of army service. They cited the war as a reason for their decision. In these days, in the midst of a severe war, the burden of inequality is more acute than ever and requires the promotion of a sustainable solution to this issue, the judges wrote. Exactly when and how this ruling will be carried out is not immediately clear. The judges referred to the gradual conscription of yeshiva students. Of course, the ruling drew immediate criticism from leaders of the ultra-religious parties who vowed to fight it. There has never been a ruling by the Supreme Court in favor of the members of the yeshiva and in the interests of the Haredi public, tweeted Moshe Gafni of United Torah Judaism. There is not a single judge there who understands the value of learning Torah and their contribution to the people of Israel in all generations. One ultra-Orthodox leader said the ruling could lead to two states, split between Haredi and non-Haredi Jews. Ruling drew applause from longtime critics of these yeshiva exemptions. Today, a new page was written in the history of the State of Israel. The Movement for Quality Government Israel, the nonprofit that spearheaded the issue for decades and filed the petition that led to this case. In a year in which we lost an entire brigade of soldiers who fell in battle or were seriously injured, in a year in which reservists served over 200 days each, there is no more justified proof that the IDF needs more personnel, said Avigdor Lieberman, who heads the right-wing secularist Israel Beitenu party. I congratulate the Supreme Court on this decision. It is a significant step on the way to historical change. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Libby Fisher-Hellman is the author of the new book, Max's War, set in the Holocaust and particularly in World War II. She lives in Chicago and writes compulsively readable thrillers. Okay, so how did you come up with that phrase?
A friend of mine wrote a blurb for me, what we call in a trade a blurb when you're doing a dust jacket quote.
Right.
And she used the phrase compulsively readable thriller. And I said, that sounds really good. I think I'm going to use that.
I think you should trademark it, actually. If it's not. You've written many crime novels, right? That's sort of,
yes.
I don't know if that's how you began, but it looks like it.
Yes.
Tell us about the transition from, you know, those are set pieces, right? Most crime stories, most crime books.
Well, yes and no. Most publishers want you to write a series. So I have two series of crime novels, both with female protagonists, and there are six books in each. But I actually started writing historical pieces from the very beginning. I was a history major in college, and I then worked in broadcast news for a while. And I was always fascinated at the fact that human beings seem to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. There may be a little change here and a little development there, but basically it's the same thing. And I just wonder why we don't learn from history. So I gravitated to, I guess you'd call them turbulent times more than just gentle times, and wanted to write about how normal, ordinary people can do extraordinary things during times of turbulence.
Now,
so that's kind of the theme of my historicals.
It's fascinating. You make an excellent point. As a Jew, thinking about how people make the same mistakes in every generation, that certainly hits home right now. I should also note, when you say you worked at broadcast news, you also worked on the McNeil Lehrer, with McNeil Lehrer at PBS
yes.
at one point.
Yes, and that was my first production job.
So it's just proof that a BA in history does not condemn one to a life of high school teaching.
That is true. That is true.
Speaking as someone with a BA in history, so.
Well, you became a rabbi, so
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, you know, we all can go off in the wrong direction. So in creating Max's War, obviously, you know, the ground of World War II has been covered and recovered many, many times, but this is not a story that's been told very much. tell us how you fleshed it out.
It was classified and top secret from the day it began in 1942 until about 1998. And then the story started leaking out. And there are a couple of books that have been written about it and a couple of fiction novels as well, but nothing to the same degree that I wrote it. There was one thing I do want to mention. The first part of the book is really a compilation of all the laws the Germans passed that stripped Jews of their rights in a cumulative fashion. And I did that consciously because I did not know exactly what laws the Germans passed that allowed them to get away with persecuting Jews. And if I didn't know, I think it's a pretty good bet that my kids don't know and the younger generation doesn't know either. So I wanted to spell it out so that it would be there someplace if someone wanted to know exactly what happened, not only to my character Max, but to all the Jews in Germany and Austria.
The beginning of the experience of anti-Semitism is interesting in the book, how it sort of rises in Max's consciousness. What did you base that on?
He was from a family that wanted to assimilate.
Clearly, yeah.
As most Germans who had education and means tried to do. And, you know, the first time it reached him, he wanted to fight about it because he was, what is this? This is crazy. And his parents, on the other hand, were like, okay, they've done this. They're not going to do any more. So there was like a push and pull between the generations. Max wanted to be much more aggressive than his parents wanted to be. And that harmed him. It harmed all of them because they were late leaving Germany and they were late getting to Holland. And then things did not go their way. So the anti-Semitism, the irony is that this came out like 6 months after what's going on in Gaza.
Right.
Which I think is the supposed anti-Semitism that's arisen from that, I think, is a whole different issue and has nothing to do with history. I mean, I just really think it has to do with the media. So we won't even go there because I'll get angry.
Yeah, you're not the only one. How long, you know, now that you know about the Ritchie boys and all of this experience, how has it changed your perception of the guy who's really the model of it, your father-in-law?
Oh, well, I have enormous compassion for him that I didn't know I had. And for his sons, he had two sons who carried a lot of his damaged goods, let's say. You know, they were the recipients of them, and I didn't understand what that was all about until now. So I think it's helped me to become more compassionate and maybe a little less judgmental, although from what I just said about the media, I didn't sound non-judgmental, did I?
I wouldn't say there's a revenge factor, but there's definitely a turning of the tables here. Does it feel like it's resolved for you at the end of the book?
No.
I mean, it can't be, can it?
No, I don't think it. What happened to Max and his girlfriend and then Renee, the other woman he's interested in, it never ends. And interestingly, you know, people say, well, are you going to write a sequel? if I ever did write a sequel, it would be about the McCarthy era, because that came so fast after World War II.
Yeah, almost immediately.
4 years later, right. We were in the heat of it. 5 years later. So, you know, it might be something that happens to Renee. Who knows?
And maybe that's the next book?
Well, maybe. Maybe she's working for the State Department.
I'm not saying that's a lead-in, but it does kind of sound like the next, a sequel.
Yeah, these things never really go away. We brush them under the carpet and we wait 10 years and they come out in a different form. Like I said, there may be a little different angle, there may be a little different perspective, but it's the same old stuff.
Boy, it is. I want to thank Libby Fisher-Hellman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about Max's War?
Well, I would love them to visit my website, which is Libby Hellman, with two L's, two N's, as we say on the East, like the mayonnaise. That's my website, LibbyHellman.com, and you will find out more than you ever wanted to know about me and the 18 books I've written.
I have to say, 18 is a very good number.
I just realized it. Oh, my God. The high of it.
It's too Jewish. I'm sorry. You can't. And by the way, Hellman's mayonnaise is about the least Jewish thing you could have said on this program, I'm pretty sure.
But you know what? It works.
It
People
does.
Don't misspell my name.
It does. Yeah. Thank you so much, Libby.
Thank you, Rabbi Sam. It was a pleasure.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Ruth Finkel Wade and other second-generation survivors talking about their book, The Ones Who Remember. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services and a delicious Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming 4th of July holiday. A classic Yiddish song from over 100 years ago. It's a celebration of America called Lebensol Columbus. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Mechayech leben, es ritt auf ihr die Schrinnele, mir sollen also leben. Mir chomes bixen, Menschenblit, darf mir auf Zuris. Ha gubernate, darf mir nicht, a kise auf Kapures. Ah, es ist gib, sing sie alle mit. Leben soll Kolumbus, trink wieder lach lechaim. Leben soll Kolumbus, von dem Land dem Naim. Seid zerfrieden, gelebt nicht in die Trumbus, schreit Schein. Lebensol Columbus, Lebensol Columbus.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.